Welcome to Agents of Smooch. Doing a retelling of Cinderella is nothing new. Even doing a feminist retelling of Cinderella has become more commonplace. But at the agency, Ever After from 1998 is one of our favorite versions. Why do we love it? Today, we are going to explore why it remains well-loved 25 years later, about. And that's a long time ago. And perhaps how it compares with other takes on this classic fairy tale. I am director Annette Weirstra, and for today's mission, I am joined by agent Katie Beth Schmidt. Hello, Katie Beth.
Hello, director.
And we also have agent Erica Ensign. Hello, Erica.
Hello, reporting for duty.
Excellent. And we cannot do this without agent Moises Chulien. Hello, Moises.
Hello, director. As our undersecretary for meat cutes and subgenre of meat cutes, I'm glad that we are finally addressing the meat fruit that is at the center of this film.
Or is it fruit cute?
Or is it fruit cute? That's the eternal argument. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Questions we shall answer in this episode.
Or not.
So Ever After places the Cinderella story in a rather English-seeming France in the 16th century. It stars, it's like, aside from telling us is France, there's some French names.
They say it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they mention it a lot. There are a lot of French names. There's Richard O'Brien's mustache, and that's the most French stuff that there is.
It is. And we have Drew Barrymore as our Cinderella, or Danielle de Barbarac, Doug Ray Scott as the entitled prince, Angelica Houston as our evil stepmother, and because all versions of Cinderella must have a fairy godmother, this version gives us Patrick Godfrey as Leonardo da Vinci, who is both godmother and wise old sage. Mm-hmm. So I know all of you have seen this movie before, and it's another one of those ones we've talked about doing before and just haven't gotten around to, but today we do. So what do you feel about this? Is it 25 years old?
Can you please stop saying how long ago this movie came out?
I'm like having trauma.
Please stop reminding me of having my 20th high school reunion having happened last year with me not present.
I saw this in the theater twice.
Yeah. Having seen it in theaters and having been a guy in high school who liked romance and writing romantic poetry and all this kind of stuff, talking about having seen the movie and enjoying the movie, I was greeted by my female friends with immediate doubt, because all the other guys were much more concerned with movies that were anything but Ever After. The action epics that would be the precursor to various superhero movies. But for my money, my opinion then matches my opinion now, that it is one of the best of its type of retellings of fairy tales, with a lot of stuff that actually ages pretty well. The treatment of Romani people as thieving gypsies, notwithstanding, pretty much the rest of the movie is pretty good, mostly because the fat jokes at Melanie Lynskey's expense, thankfully, are something that villainous people do, and then the villainous people get their comeuppance. That doesn't make me okay with them being there. I think that's one of the tropiest of tropes that needs to just kind of go out the window, or at least, you know, not to the extent that it is just like that's her entire character arc is getting made fun of. I am thrilled that as very old in Tom Holland Spider-Man terms as this movie is now, I'm really quite delighted by being able to spin it up and not cringe at multiple elements of it or much of anything, the way that I do revisiting a lot of things that are a couple decades or more old.
I'm very sorry for the sentence I'm about to say. In 1998, I was 11 years old.
Oh my God.
Yes, tell us more, my
You've
child.
You've been booted from this mission.
I had a record player as a child. It's okay. I had to call for things, you know. I did not see this in theaters, but I rented the VHS many times from our local movie place. And it was, in fact, the second DVD I owned because I watched it over and over and over. So my mother took pity on me and bought it for me. So she would stop having to pay to rent it every month. It was also one of the first CDs I owned, the score. And it was the first time I'd ever paid attention to who a director was of a movie. And it was specifically because in the liner notes for the CD, Andy Tennant talks about who was the director, talks about how George Fenton's music made him able to reconnect with the work because during the editing process, he had gotten so like separate from it. He'd like lost his emotional connection to what he was making, and that like adding the score in made him actually feel the story again. And I just remember being like, a man can direct a romance movie? That seems a little weird, but okay. Little did I know. But I have very vivid memories of watching this over and over. And I remember my mother watching it with me, and we got to the credits and her saying, oh, of course the shoes are Ferragamo. And that's when I started paying attention to who shoe designers were. So this holds a very, very special place in my heart. And I would agree that it holds up very beautifully, minus the fat jokes, which didn't, I remembered them as worse than they were. Not that they're great, but
I did too.
Yeah, I feel like it's more the stepmother saying horrible things than, you know, like it being a cultural thing. Like nobody else really says that to her, minus the stepmother and the sister. And obviously the constant use of the slur term for the Romani people, which did not age well. And I wish everybody else would notice that. But beyond that, it's beautiful and made me very interested in French history, which came in handy in high school. And it's just, it's such a good retelling of Cinderella that I don't know that I've seen a new one since this one came out. I was perfectly happy with this one. I know.
I mean, the Disney live action Cinderella just made me want to watch this.
Yeah, like I've seen pictures mm-hmm. of the dress, and that's all I needed. I wanna look at. I actually somewhere in my parents' house have the unopened pattern for her dress she wears to the ball.
Wow.
Ooh, I was thinking that I would like that dress.
I'll always have to see it. It was sized for a teenager though, so God only knows how old it is. But
yeah.
It's such a good movie. I think it treats everybody as a human person and certainly doesn't make the prince just a boring prince with no name, like I think a lot of other Cinderellas do. So how could you not love it?
You know what? I didn't love it the first time I saw it. I don't know if I was going in, because I saw it in the theater, I'm pretty sure, like when it came out. And I don't know if I was expecting something more fantastical, you know, like they say, you know, the Brothers Grimm, like, oh, the version with the pumpkin carriage and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's what I was just in the mood for the first time that I saw it. And the fact that it, like, so you're starting with a framing device of the Brothers Grimm. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And then it went back and it was just like actual, you know, historical times. And I think at the time I just wanted something a little more escapey. And that's not what this was. Also, I was not a Drew Barrymore fan at all, but I love Cinderella and I love Cinderella's story so much that I was like, okay, I have to go see this. And then she's got this accent and I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That does not sound right to me.
Her accent is not great.
And then you had Duke Gray Scott, who, like, I love Duke Gray Scott a lot, but at the time I didn't. And I still don't find him like handsome in a way that I find attractive. I find him charismatic, but like handsome, not in a Prince Charming sort of way. So like, I just found myself kind of, I didn't hate it or anything, but I found myself kind of bemused by the whole thing. And I really did actually like Patrick Godfrey as Leonardo da Vinci the first time I saw it. So that was the one bit of the movie that I quite liked all the way along. And I was just sort of like, eh, you know, it's a fairy tale, fine, whatever. And I just sort of kind of forgot about it. And then at some point after I moved to Canada, I'm pretty sure they brought it back to like the super cheap theater that's not even open anymore, I don't think. You know, sticky floors and seats that don't particularly work very well. And they, for some reason, they were showing Ever After years after it had come out. It was just, you know, every once in a while they do that. And I went by myself and I sat there and I watched it and I was like, what was I thinking? This is amazing. This movie is so good. And I think by then it was like, I mean, in 1998, I was still, that's the year I graduated from college. And I, like, I didn't know nothing. I was a, just ridiculously naive, silly young person. And I had a lot of, like I refused for a long time. I refused to admit that I liked like boy bands, like the Backstreet Boys, because it wasn't cool to like. Yeah, it wasn't cool to like Drew Barrymore. And I've gotten over all of that nonsense. And I had by the time that I saw this again. So I was like, you know what?
At the end of the day, nobody wants to be lonely.
But I was just like, you know what? Drew Barrymore may not be my favorite actress, but she really does have star power. She's got charisma, and it comes through in this movie. Du Gray Scott is charming as all get out, like charisma-wise, and they work together very well. And by the time I saw it the second time in the theater, I was all about retellings of fairy tales that are a little bit different and that actually take place in the real world and don't necessarily have the fantastical elements. So I had sort of shed all of the things that I didn't love. So I've seen it multiple times since then because I just love it. And if it was ever on TV, I would just watch it. And I was very happy to have an excuse to pull it up and watch it for this. And just enjoying the whole thing. The one thing I will say is that the flaw in the Persian rug is the song at the end during the credits, because I think as I tweeted, like, it's like a parody of the kind of song that you would expect to be over a fairy tale romance. Like, it's just, I really, really, really don't like it at all. So I have a tendency, usually I watch the credits all the way until the end because I am that person. But this movie, I just can't do it.
And it's an earworm because it has been in my head for days.
Oh, no. See, I didn't think it was catchy enough for that. I couldn't tell you anything about it right now.
I actually have no, I'm like, I don't know who sings it. I don't know what
Texas.
The words are. I paid no attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the band Texas, not like a well-known band. I turned to Steven and I was like, I don't even know who that is. And he's like, oh, the reason I've heard of the band Texas is because the band that Ricky Gervais's character had in The Office apparently opened for Texas. And like, that's the only reason that he knew the name of the band Texas. I was like, that tracks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no fairy tale, you know, modern era, you know, 1980s plus fairy tale movie end credit song more iconic than "My love is like a storybook," or "Our love is like a storybook story."
Oh,
they're
all bad. That song so much.
I just mute the reflexively know when to mute when the credits hit.
Yes. Yeah, and I have a friend that got married to that song, and it was really hard not to cringe and like make sure nobody saw my face. that's what I feel like this song is, right? Like yeah. This song is trying so hard to be that song, which is not good. Sorry, everybody.
Aspire to other things, guys.
Yeah. It reminds me of another, it's not quite a fairy tale, but in the similar vein of Prince of Thieves and
that's
Everything
exactly
what
I
Do.
Was gonna say.
Yep. By Brian Adams.
Which,
yeah. How many weddings did I go at that time, including one of my brothers, who used that as their wedding song? I'm like, I hate this song so much. Apologies to people who got married to it.
I think that was the song for homecoming when I was in high school that year. So,
it was everywhere.
You know, the big element of this retelling that I like the most, they don't go all the way there, but one of the things that has bugged me for the longest time about fairy tales since I started reading like Danielle in the movie and learning more about societal structures and you know, the oppression of the working class and so on, is the notion of the aspiration to aristocracy. Mm-hmm. And how, well, but as long as they're thinking aristocrats, they aristocrats can be good, actually, and it's good for there to be a ruling class. And I like the amount of pushback that we get on the notion of, well, the old ways, the uneducated ways, the feudal ways should continue on, because the way that this feels like it is telling that is that that sort of evolution sociologically is a long, long-term process. And in theory, this was in the history of France and in the history of Western Europe, this was part of the push toward that sort of enlightenment. And the notion that, you know, when people read books and when people actually stop to think about the way that things are and the way that things are run, maybe just another king, another queen that are a little bit better than the last one is not the best that we can do in each generation. Politics play a role in this, but I think just in terms of the warm, fuzzy feelings that fairy tales are supposed to leave us with, that there's supposed to be some goodness, there's supposed to be some light, there's supposed to be something learned from doing things the right way, not just the way that they've always been done. That's one of the things that I like most in fairy tales. There could be a symposium full of arguments about, you know, what is and is not the most important aspect of a fairy tale. But for me, that kind of humanist aspect of things is what's at the heart of this movie. And I think one of the reasons that that I liked it at first glance and have loved it these many years.
They even mention the revolution, like the French Revolution, because she's talking about the painting, the old woman who is basically narrating, talking about how the painting hung in the, I don't know, the palace or whatever, until the revolution. So they don't shy away from sort of the idea that the aristocracy was a thing that was going to eventually be on its way out.
There's a line, too, I think, where Prince Henry says something like, oh, I just need to bring my father into the 16th century, which just made me laugh.
That is a great every time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, how many times have we said that about the 21st? Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things it does do, like related to what you're saying, Moises, is it like leans into the I'm a prince and it's so hard being a prince. But then she pushes back on it and does the... it's almost like with great responsibility, great power comes great responsibility. This predates that movie, I think. But it's like essentially that same theme is she's pushing back on, like, you know, like quit your whining.
And he's like, and she's not even the only character that dresses him down for stuff that he does. Like the other thing that they lean into is, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, who was, you know, one of the great minds pushing toward thought and development and stuff. And yeah, and he totally upbraids the prince later on and being like, I can't remember his exact lines, but he's basically saying like, you're an idiot. You have done this wrong. You need to go and find her. And I like the fact that the prince has, as you said before, that the prince has a personality, which is a great thing because that doesn't always happen. But the fact that his personality is so, like, lackluster in terms of, you know, he doesn't have the sparkle and the wit and the drive. That's really it, is like he does not have the drive that she has, and she pushes him to sort of be a better version of himself. And, you know, he's sort of inspired by Leonardo, but he doesn't actually do anything until he has Danielle pushing at him. And like, he never really has to save her, which is my favorite thing about this, like, especially at you know, toward the end, where she has been taken in by Pierre Le Pew, and, you know, you think, oh God, this is going to go really, really horribly wrong. And he's riding up to save her. And like, every time I see this movie, I think, oh my God, I hope he gets there in time. And then like somewhere along the line, I remember, oh right, she doesn't need him. She saves herself at every turn. So she's just like wandering out of this big, ugly, harsh looking castle. And like, what are you doing here? It's so great.
He's like the tuxedo mask to her Sailor Moon. Like, he shows up and flourishes his cape and she's got it under control. And are you done talking? Because Princess needs to get back to saving herself. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like how she's like, she asks, what are you doing there? And he's like, I came to save you. And then he kind of recants. And then he's like, actually, I'm here. and confesses his love for her, which is like a much better answer. But yep. he does get caught and like, well, I'm here to save you. And it's like, I didn't need no saving, thanks. Mm-hmm. But really, he came to tell her he loves her.
And apologize, which is the most important part of that whole scene.
I think one of the things I like about it as a retelling is the character of the evil stepmother and her daughters, Marguerite and Jacqueline. And I always like when you have the daughters not like cookie cutters of each other. So you have like two women taking very different approaches to the terribleness of their mother. I don't love that they set it up that Jacqueline does that because her mother thinks she's fat, but she just sees through all the garbage of Marguerite and the Baroness and becomes a better person through it. And I like that.
I like the fact that she's not perfect either. Like in the scene where she is tending to the whip marks on Danielle's back, she starts off by saying, you know, you really brought this on yourself. So like she is still part of that, you know, bit of the aristocracy who feels like, you know, servants should mind their place. And she does have, you know, not as big an arc as the prince does, but like she has a bit of a character arc as well. You know, she's never really in love with the way that her mother is treating Danielle, but she doesn't really do anything about it. And at that point, like I remember kind of going, oh, you brought this on yourself. Like that's a terrible thing to say.
It's terrible.
And yeah, and it's like you could tell she doesn't entirely believe it, but still she's saying it out loud. And by the end of the movie, she's very much not the kind of person I think who would even go there and say that. And like, so you get actual, I think the only one who is almost entirely a caricature is Marguerite, but that's mm-hmm. kind of okay because she's the, you know, she's the young, you know, teenagers don't know anything. And that's like kind of where she is. And Angelica Houston, who is just amazing in this, like her character has like, she's terrible, but she really loved Danielle's dad. Like if that's mm-hmm. clear from the very first scene, like, you know, when he's dying, the reason she hates Danielle so much is because mm-hmm. the man that she loved turns away from her to this, you know, snot-nosed dirty kid to say goodbye instead of saying goodbye to her. And that just like plants that seed of awfulness that just, you know, never quite goes away. And even when they're talking about him years later, did you love my father? And she's just like, I barely knew him. But you could tell, oh yeah, she's still brokenhearted over this. And that doesn't make you like her necessarily as a person any better, because she's still doing terrible things, but she feels like a much more well-rounded character than a lot of wicked stepmother characters, because she actually has, you know, she's got real feelings. And in a way, I feel like it makes her more effective as a villain, because you know that she's doing these things and still like there's room in her heart for love, and yet she still doesn't have it for Danielle. Mm-hmm. And that's like, whoa, that's ouch. That's a big ouch.
I want to walk back a little bit of something that I said about Jacqueline earlier based on something you just said, Erica, because I think upon rewatch, the thing that I appreciated more and then promptly forgot about, I think probably due to too strong a pot of coffee that I poured myself, is that the really beautiful thing about her progression was, yes, she's complicit. Yes, she's in that mindset, but she was captive in that toxicity provided to her by her mother, and her arc journey over the course of the movie is breaking all the way free of that and breaking free and leaving behind toxic people that she needs to cut out of her life. And it's something that, again, the fat jokes are incredibly regrettable, but even 20 plus years on, it is really quite clean how that break from toxicity journey is for her compared to other attempts to do it in a much more shorthanded, much less nuanced way, or at least in a way that we get that much time with her character. And if anything, we get to see her journey is the journey that her mother could have gone on, but her mother is just never going to break out of those cycles of toxicity. And the only thing that I would argue with you on, not that I really ever argue with you about anything because we're far from nemesis, is that I think in the way that the stepmother perceives love as property acquisitions and the kind of merger and acquisitions thing that they were at the time, that's her perception of love. When she says you know, that she loved Danielle's father, she means something totally different than Danielle means when she uses the word love. Love is a transactional thing for the stepmother. And in the way that she perceives it, that's just that in that way. Yeah, absolutely. But it doesn't mean the same kind of sentiment and built trust kind of thing that it means to Danielle and to hopefully all of us.
You know, that does make sense, because I, even when I was watching the movie this time, I was sort of thinking about that and about, you know, her character as not just a stepmother, but as a mother. And I was like, yeah, like, does she love her daughters? Like, even the ones that she is good to, it does seem like she's good to them because they are her stepping stones to becoming more powerful herself and getting her out of this backwater, you know, mansion and into a castle instead, as opposed to the actual warmth and care that Danielle's father felt for her, bringing her books and reading to her in bed. It was a very different kind of parental relationship.
Well, and I think that that's such a good point, because if you look at so you meet the girls, Danielle is 8. They don't tell you how old the other two are, but they're close in age. And Danielle's father has raised her from birth, because it sounds like she lost her mother in birth, right? She's never known her mother. And he doesn't have that ingrained thought process that the Baroness has with her daughters of like, my purpose is to raise this child to marry well so that we can increase our holding or we can get a title or whatever else. His entire purpose is this child doesn't have a mother. I have to be both. He's going to raise her. And so he showers her with love and affection that you don't see in, I would say, any of the other parental relationships, right? Like if you look at the king and queen, and in the prince that Henry is based on had siblings, but in this film, Henry doesn't have siblings, right? He's an only child. And they're very much like, you have to get married because we have to join with Spain. And you have to get married because you need to grow up. And there's not this nurture to that relationship. And I think the mother has it somewhat, but I think the mother is also kind of like, I need to push you out of the nest because you're never going to go otherwise, unless you're running away. And the Baroness has that feeling of like, your purpose as my children is to grow up, be good ladies, behave yourself in public, not embarrass me, and marry well, so that we can continue to have titles and grow our land holding and whatever else. So I think that I think it's part of what makes Danielle stand out as a character as far as everyone else in her age group, because she's got a parent whose focus isn't her marriage ability and her comportment in public and how she is going to help him in the long run, right? It's really just like, I need to show her love because she doesn't have enough of it.
Well, and I think if you look at the king and queen, they are equally transactional. And even Henry says to them, like, that marriage never did anyone any good, like the transactional marriage. And yet, by the end of the movie, like, they're all in conflict at the beginning because they all want Henry to grow up. And when he starts finding his direction, and you're seeing them at the wedding when they're like giggling together and stuff, and you're just like, and at the end, they're united front as a family. And it's just like, this doesn't feel like, I think it shows that the arranged marriage, that transactional marriage, can lead to love and like companionability or whatever. And like, they seem at least fond of each other, if not deeply in love, you know. But so like, I kind of like them as a couple by the end. And when you see them together, you think like, they seem like not too bad parents. They're just dealing with a petulant teenager at the beginning, even though he doesn't seem like a teenager. He's older.
And I love their reaction when, you know, to their reaction to the reaction of the king and queen of Spain.
Yes.
When you have like, it's quite like that scene itself is a little over the top for me. Her crying is just a little too much. Like, that's the one piece of the acting in the movie that's just a little over the top, but
it earns it.
Yeah. It's far enough over the top that it sort of swings around and almost makes it back to funny for me, but just not quite. But the fact that she is also in love with somebody who is not this prince that she's never met before, and, you know, their reaction So his parents' reaction to their reaction is one of my favorite things about the movie, because they're just like, you know, it could be worse. Look at them.
Well, and the man she was in love with looks quite a bit older than he is, or than you know. So you're like, that's a much older man she is choosing to be in love with.
You know, Henry has a certain amount of personality. We don't get to see the amazing personality that he has.
It's true. That's true. We don't know their story. That's a whole other movie.
Some, you know, I think it was Katie Beth mentioned earlier that you know, Henry has a personality, and generally in more recent modernizations of these fairy tales, the personality that they give these princes is really not that much more than, you know, a title and a haircut and some dimples, and you know. A little bit of depth beyond that, but nothing compared to what we get from Henry. So again, this guy, the princess of Spain has fallen for, that's the spinoff that we never got, that we should have gotten, was their romance and just how he made her swoon.
He looks like he runs a little shop and he has no money. And every time they cut to him in that scene and his hair is all messed up, he's so distraught and he's crying and he's trying to be supportive. And I always have this flash of like what the actual monarchy is like. And I think if you just wait a month, like they're going to be back with you. It's fine. You know, but I mean, not to comment on any countries across the pond from us, but you know, it's a thing that happens. Right. And so I always think that, but I'm like, no, like she loves this sad little man and she just wants to be with him. And I will say the crying, the first time I ever saw this movie, I remember thinking, why is she crying so much? Is her corset too tight? Like what's happening? Because she squeaks as she kneels and it sounds like she can't move in her outfit.
Which is probably also true.
Yeah. 1998 costuming. You never hard. Know.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I just love that Henry is like, you know what? This is ridiculous. I like this country situation does not matter as much as the fact that I don't want to be married to this sobbing woman who clearly is with this tiny man and I love somebody else. And, I have always noticed that he never wears a crown until the scene after he's married Danielle, when they call the Baroness and the daughters to the court. It's the only time he wears a crown in the whole movie.
Wow.
And Danielle has the crown too. So I think that's a nice little costuming choice, but yeah, he doesn't even at the wedding, like it's not until he assumes the full responsibility of both his emotions and his role as the prince and stops like dallying around being ridiculous that he really like inhabits who that is. But I also love that he has it off in that final scene where they're back at the house, because it's for show, right? Like that's really just like, let's intimidate the Baroness. But yeah, because the Spanish princess has a crown on with her veil, but he doesn't.
What a delightful touch. I've never noticed that before. That's amazing.
I think about these costumes a lot.
We can't confine his swoopy hair too much, which is very of that era, and I love it.
He is such a babe in this movie, and I remember looking him up in whatever way you look people up at the end of the 90s, which was not IMDb, because that did not exist yet.
It involved a private detective.
Right. Well, I just remember being like, what else is this man in? And all I could find was like, what, some kind of action movies or something? And I was like,
it probably was IMDb, because it's been around since 1990. Like I remember looking stuff up at this time, but it was basically like Wikipedia. It was all fan sourced. Yeah. Early on. Yeah.
98 would have been around the time that IMDb was generally consumable by the general public, and it wasn't the kind of not as easy to navigate thing as it was in the early going.
I think I probably googled him though.
I think he is also, like, he was frequently a villain.
Yes,
in action movies. And he remained, like, that was kind of his thing for a lot of his career.
And it was right around that time that he was initially cast as Wolverine in the X-Men movie, which had a bunch of nerds up in arms.
Wow.
And and that he couldn't do it because of a contractual obligation to something something else that he was in first position for. The nerds got their way in that that handsome guy from the Cinderella movie didn't get it. But then the nerds all were up in arms over some 7 foot tall Australian handsome guy, you know, who was no better than this English handsome guy.
That guy who was in Oklahoma in Australia.
Yeah. Oh, some music theater guy singing and dancing. That's not Wolverine. And now all of them don't think that anybody should play Wolverine who isn't 7 feet tall and Australian. But Dougray Scott would have been weird for me as Wolverine just because he, I mean, he can play sinister. He can play a little devilish, but it's just, I don't know. I've seen him in so many other things that, that I feel like are a better way of employing his kind of roguish quality. I'm kind of glad he didn't get that part.
Yeah. I'm trying to picture it. And like, I mean, for me, he is Doctor Who's Dougray Scott because he was in one of my favorite, Matt Smith episodes. Hi.
Same.
Yep. And I think he gets to use his actual Scottish accent in that, if I'm not remembering incorrectly.
And it's possible I watched that last night because you can't watch one without the other in my mind, apparently. But yes. And that's, and that episode is a romance too.
It is one of the most romantic
episodes.
I'm like, it's so lovely. And I love that. He's so handsome.
One of, I mean, this is going off on a Doctor Who tangent, and I'm sure that everybody's going to mind. But one of my favorite subgenre of Doctor Who episodes are the Doctor as Fairy Godmother, just trying to make something work for a couple of kids trying to make it. That's one of my favorite things is the Doctor getting to play the Leonardo da Vinci part in trying to, you know, help some people get along.
Hyde is an Ever After remake, you're saying?
Oh,
I don't know. Like
with time travel and monsters.
Yes, and monsters, yeah.
Speaking of Doctor Who connections, this movie has more than just that because Toby Jones is also in it as the creepy royal page, who he was in Doctor Who as well. The guy who played Leonardo, Patrick Godfrey, was in a couple of Doctor Who stories, I think two, three Doctor Who stories from like classic Doctor Who from like the 60s and 70s. And also, as we were watching the credits before I turned it off because of the song, we discovered that some of the stunts were done by Terry Walsh, who was like one of the stuntmen during the Third Doctor era from Action by Havoc. So like, I'm like, he must have been probably the stunt double for when Leonardo falls over in the water or something, because Terry Walsh is, you know, not young in 1998. So lots of Doctor Who connections.
I will say that last night I messaged Annette and said, I know that the Mona Lisa was not on canvas because I've seen City of Death, and it's on a piece of board that says this is a fake underneath in spray paint. but it is historical fact that he did keep the Mona Lisa with him until he died, and it was on a board, which I think is kind of cool. Like, you make something so beautiful that you will not give it up.
That is lovely.
Ruby might have sent me into some like thrills of really loving Leonardo da Vinci for a few years after I first saw it.
See, it's like historical fact. And
I didn't even realize that the painting, like the painting of her, of Danielle, I did not actually, because I don't know anything about Leonardo da Vinci except for the few things that I learned from Doctor Who from City of Death. And that did not include that particular painting, Head of a Woman. So I only just now happened to look up the Wikipedia page for this movie. And there's the picture of like the actual painting. And I was like, oh, that's not Drew Barrymore after all. Like, there's an actual painting.
Yeah, they modified it a little bit to make it look more like Drew Barrymore. And the reason I knew it was a real painting is around the time the movie came out, I think it was Xerox, and I could be totally wrong, but one of the companies that my mom's office that she was working in at the time sourced their paper stock or something office-y from had Leonardo da Vinci designs all over their boxes for a while. Whoa. And that was one of the things on the box. And I just remember her calling me from work, because I was a latchkey kid. So I remember calling me from work to make sure I was home from school, and her being like, you have to see this box that I have at the office. That's awesome. On it from Ever After.
I also love all of the little inventions, like the boat shoes and the things. And, you know, like when he unlocks the door by just removing the hinges, yes. and he's like, I will go down in history as a man who opened a door. And he just laughs. And it's like, he's such a charming character. That it's like, it's yes, it's a little ridiculous that Leonardo da Vinci's in this movie, but I love it. Mm-hmm. It's magical.
It's just, it's such a nice choice to, instead of having like a random person, like, here, have a historical figure that you might learn about.
Also, right. the idea that like the fantastical version of Cinderella has a fairy godmother who is literally magical and can change things with, you know, a wave of a wand. And this is the 100% opposite of that. Not only is it not a woman, but it is somebody who is very into science, like the, yeah. you know, the polar opposite. So it really helps ground this idea where like it's still a fairy tale and it's still very romantic, but it's the real world. It's you know, it's science is going to save the day, not magic.
Yeah, as much as I love magic and the potential for magic in storytelling, going the grounded route and going that route for a reason is the reason that I think it holds together so well. In a broader sense, I gave the co-writer director Andy Tennant a lot of credit for this movie, and then would go on to basically not like many of his other rom-coms, like Fool's Gold and Sweet Home Alabama, which
Alabama.
I have philosophical issues with the whole. It's almost the inverse of this. It's no, you need to go with the entrenched mores of where you're from and not rock the boat and not get highfalutin city girl thoughts in your head. I just that's something that bugged me about it, even though I was disposed toward wanting to watch it because you know, I like Reese Witherspoon. I don't know.
But that movie came out at a time where it was believable that someone wouldn't choose Patrick Dempsey, because a few years later, nobody was ever going to believe that ever again.
Well, yep.
I didn't like either of them was the thing. I wanted her to choose herself because I found both of them repellent in different ways.
I think we should talk about Marguerite as a character, because she is such a caricature, but also she's hilarious. And I think the moment where she gets so angry about finding out what Danielle is up to and then is like, puts out a full on temper tantrum and then is like, ah, if there was a bee, is like so ridiculous. But also she kind of seems to get away with it. And because I don't know, she makes me laugh every time.
Her line readings are just so hysterical. And she takes what could have been a caricature in a bad way into being someone that's incredibly funny. And there, I at least believe that, no, truly, she could be this like one track mind and terrible. Like, no, she's been raised to believe that she should be queen, if not, you know, really rich and titled. So yeah, I kind of love the idea of her as a representation of her mother's desires and goals for her children, and that she gets sucked into it. And I also just, it's really fun to see somebody play a really delicious villain and like clearly have a great time with it. And like, even though I think she's horrible, I enjoy every second she's on the screen, because she just brings it to every scene.
Her comic timing is unbelievably good.
Incredible.
I still every now and then just think about, like, when this movie is nowhere to be found, I will just randomly think, there was a bee. Like, she's so perfect.
Some people are living cartoons, said the man who sometimes operates as a living cartoon. And it's delicious the way that she embraces it, because I have known people to act out in utterly unhinged ways like that, and then otherwise seem like a completely rational human being. And that she lends that realism to something that, to your point, and in so many adaptations of this story, has been the most cartoonish part, more over the top than the stepmother. That she deserves a special plaudits for that.
And I did not have sisters that I didn't get along with. Like, I get along very well with my sister, so I did not have this kind of a relationship. But I knew people who had combative relationships with their sisters and their siblings. So specifically, I'm thinking of the scene where, you know, Danielle has just acted out, and the next morning she comes in to see Marguerite and her mother holding Danielle's dress up and being like, oh, you know, no, you think you're going to get to go anywhere? And just like the idea that she has like, oh, the sisters, like that is the look on Marguerite's face is perfect, because I've seen that look from the jerky sister more than once, being like, I have the upper hand. And it doesn't matter that you always have the upper hand, because you literally always do. You're going to take that, you know, awful pleasure in it every single time. And she just really does.
When they chase each other around the house screaming.
Oh, yes. And when she gets punched.
Yes. Oh my God. It's just, it's again, like she brings 110% to that comedy. Like she plays it so well that it's hysterical. And I don't feel terrible that this character got punched in the face, because I frankly feel like she probably could have been punched in the face. And I don't condone punching people in the face, but.
And she's the reason for, I think, for what for me is the most heartbreaking moment in the entire film, including the time that she's watching her dad die, is when Marguerite takes the book and is going to throw it in the fireplace. And then finally, Danielle relents and's like, okay, fine, here are the shoes. And she does it anyway. And it is just, that's one of the most heartbreaking scenes in movie history. It's like, no.
Yeah. Like, it's a very, like she is what her mother made her to be. Like, there is no, like, I feel like the mother probably isolated the sisters and turned them against each other and made them feel like they were competitors, and obviously treated Danielle even worse. But, like, there is no love between those two girls at all.
Yeah.
I also like how they play Prince Henry, where he is polite and charming enough with her that they feel like they're winning and making progress. But when you read it, you know that he is already given his heart away to someone else. So you can see sort of like the facade of like, I am playing the game here, but they think they're winning, but they're not winning, which is also why I think she's so angry when she finds out that she's been losing the game all along. Because it is a game for them.
He's doing that to placate his parents. That is the only reason he talks to Marguerite at all.
But I love the scene with the tennis match, and you turn around and she's standing outside of the net holding that ball and like trying to be super flirtatious, but also like so dangerous. Like, I just feel like you do not want to mess with this woman, because she is going to make your life hell.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God. And the moment where he goes over the little low wall into the netting where all the women are. Yes. And he comes back out and his doublet is just full of handkerchiefs. Yep. Holding them out. Oh God. It's such,
what a lovely touch.
Yes. It's just like, I feel like they do such nice little vignettes that you really get a sense of what the world is that these characters inhabit. And that's one of those moments where it's like, we understand as viewers that the point of the story is everybody wants the prince, but like that scene really drives home, like, no, he's not just really cute. Like, everybody wants the prince, and here's all these women sticking their hankies on him to prove it.
So like, let's talk about this in comparison to some of the other presentations we've seen. One of the ones I think of, which came out a little later, was Ella Enchanted, and aimed, I think, at a younger audience, and also a musical that hit some of the similar notes. We talked about the live action one that came out with Lily James. And then James. We had one come out just last year that came out on Prime, I think. And they all seem to, like, especially those last two, I feel like are trying to be Ever After, but just to me seem really derivative. But,
and I mean, as musical adaptations of it go, I still stand by the Brandy and Whitney Houston one from the 90s. I'm sure the Amazon one was fine, but I mean, I've got access to the Brandy and Whitney one, and I'll get around to it at some point.
I will say I have never seen the Brandy Cinderella.
I haven't either.
Me either.
A lot of people want to throw me out for that, but
no, it's wonderful.
plenty of friends in my age group can't believe it. But I've been told it's wonderful, and I've seen clips. But I grew up with, because it was on the Disney Channel a lot, both the Julie Andrews version of Rodgers and Hammerstein and the Leslie Ann Warren version, which is like, for me as a kid, there was the cartoon Cinderella and there was Leslie Ann Warren Cinderella. And so those, like, this was like a big step of like, oh, you liked this movie and these songs a lot. Like, here's these characters as people. But I will say, I don't remember if I saw Ella Enchanted the film, but I really adored the book. And I was mad when I heard what the changes were from the film or to the film from the book. So I kind of shunned it at that point. But the book makes it very interesting, right? Like there's a, it's the magical Cinderella. There's a curse on her. She has the book where she can see things. And the prince is a person that she, you know, helps to see how he can be better and everything else. So I think that one is probably emotionally closer.
I quite like it. It is quite similar in a lot of the themes. I never read the book, so I have no feelings, but all those items you mentioned are in it because she's cursed in that she cannot lie, I believe.
Yes. In the book, she can't. She has to follow every order given to her.
Oh, that's it. Yes, she has to follow every order, and then her evil stepsisters figure this out and make her life really trying. And of course, then like there's the prince who's used to commanding people who keeps saying things to her that force her to follow his command, and that's sort of like an evolution of his entire and like the same sort of themes around entitlement and. The ruling class and those sorts of pieces really come out. Plus there's some fun musical items in it. So it's quite fun. I'd pick Ever After, but I am quite fond of Ella Enchanted.
I think I've seen it, but it's been a while. I actually almost rewatched it the other day and something else caught my eye. So I didn't, so I don't really remember it. One thing that I do like in this that depend, and I can't think of other specific ones, retellings, but one thing I like about this is the fact that they actually kiss, like they have a real nice kiss before the end, before he knows who she is, before they have been engaged to be married. And I just they have this scene when they're in the Roma camp, and it's just like it's the first time that they can actually just relax and truly be themselves. And you know, and the fact that they kiss, like it's not nobody makes a big deal of it, which it seems nice to me. I just like it. It's like these are two people, and yes, that's what happens when you fall when you start falling for somebody, you kiss them. That I mean, not always, but. But in a case like this, for sure. And, you know, nobody's shaming them for it. Nobody's, you know, it's not Regency England where like, oh, you've just ruined your chances to do literally anything ever.
The working classes haven't abided by that for centuries.
Well, that's true.
The working classes knew what was up is what.
We have an average life expectancy of 30 years, so we got to get while the getting's good.
Well, and there's a really nice moment where they kiss and it goes really quiet around them, and it feels like it's a musical choice because it feels like it's making the statement about like when you kiss somebody and you love them, and you feel like it's only the two of you, and there's the silence, and then all of a sudden you hear the people around them going ooh,
yep.
And you realize, oh no, it was silent because everybody was watching them, and it's kind of it's kind of such a funny little choice that always cracks me up because you think it's one thing and then the bait and switch there of like, oh no, everybody's paying attention to them. They think it's funny.
I don't know. I may be restating something that I said and that we've all said, but if there's an element of this that puts ahead of other Cinderella adaptations, other fairy tale adaptations with the girl and the prince as the basic setup, the thing I love most about it is that we actually develop that relationship, and it isn't something that they hewed closer to the, well, they barely had any interaction whatsoever and then fell madly in love and everything's going to be happily ever after. I feel better about this romance because they have that progression of getting to know each other, albeit with, intentionally mistaken identities involved. There is that growth of a relationship between the two of these people that goes into those themes of, you know, maybe romance shouldn't just be this transactional property based sort of thing. And that to me is why the movie still works 20 plus years later.
Well, and there's this really nice element of Prince Henry even talking to his mother, and she's like, did you even let her get a word in edgewise? And he's like, oh my God, no, I didn't. And so there's this understanding of like his faults as a human being. And yes, I'm the prince, but I should let people finish their sentences when they talk. And then he immediately turns around in the next scene at the ball and does it to her again with even more disastrous results. And I like that element of he is a human being and human beings are going to fail even when they realize where they should be better. And that moment for some reason just really strikes me as a very realistic thing every time I see it, because he's just so excited to see her that he forgets everything that he talked to his mother about like being a better listener and, you know, like treating other people who aren't the king and the queen with respect. So I love that because there is that growth for him as a character, and you do see it in fits and starts.
It's Leonardo that calls him out that second time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and he stands in the rain. I had never really noticed. He's standing there with a slouchy, dejected posture in the rain with the shoe.
Yep.
And I've always been amused by the image of him with the shoe in the rain. I'm usually really upset because that is an expensive shoe. And he's just got in the rain. But last night when I was watching it, I just burst out laughing because he is just like sad boy in the rain with his shoe.
So like, emo.
Pouting about his choices.
Yeah. He has room to grow. He has things that he needs to improve on, and he doesn't fix them the first time. He doesn't even necessarily fix them the second time, but he shows the initiative and the interest in continuing to grow and change and be better. And that's more important than him getting it right on the second try or even the third try. That he is in this for the long haul, and that we see who he is as somebody who honestly feels like he's kind of been lied to by this whole, well, you're a prince and this is how things are and everything's perfect and your life's perfect and everything's supposed to go this way and that way. And that the adolescent in him is getting kicked to the curb before our eyes, and we get to see the sad boy next to a well, basically, you know, emo self emerge. Like that kind of vulnerability is why I like him. And it is so difficult to get me. It's really tough to get me to actually like the prince in most of these things anymore, because there isn't that layer of vulnerability and flaw that we get to see. You know, he still has to be some sort of like Captain America, wrong country and continent. You know, some sort of paragon of virtue that has some sort of flawless, inherent, inborn nature. And this guy is not that at all.
I like the ending of it, too, where they are in the window and saying, like, well, we're supposed to live happily ever after. And they're like, well, who says that? And like, they say that. And then you jump back to the narrator who's like, I think her final line is something like, the point is, gentlemen, that they lived. So it's not like they're going to live. They're going to live their life. They're going to fight. They're going to do good things. They're going to do bad things. Good things will happen. And it's like, it's not happily ever after. It's about them loving and living, you know? And I think that's one of the problematic elements of fairy tales, is like the princess narrative with the happily ever after. It's like, well, that doesn't actually exist, and this movie is trying to show you like what that looks like in real life, quote unquote real life, you know.
That for me, I mean, because I was so young when I first saw this was before I'd ever read a romance novel or like really paid much attention to things outside of like for children romancy things. So that has always really stuck with me, is like, the point is they lived. Like, they were human beings in this story. Yes, they're fictional people, but they were human beings and they lived, and they aren't always going to be happy. And I think that was like a really formative storytelling choice for me as somebody watching this. And I think that's probably why I like it is so much more than all the other Cinderella things, because you kind of have to wonder, like, okay, are these cartoons really going to be happy? Possibly not. As long as nobody draws something scary near them. But I believe it with these characters. I believe that they are going to challenge each other, because they very much have that fighty relationship in a very cute, flirtatious way. And I think that that ground is there, and they are going to grow out of that basis that they've created with each other.
Yeah, their relationship grows as a relationship because some of the challenges that they have to overcome are challenges between each other, you know, personality wise, as opposed to a version of the story where the challenges are entirely external, where it's circumstances and, you know, magic and whatever else that's coming in between them. In this case, we've actually seen them, as we've said again and again in this episode, we've seen them interact with each other and learn who the other is as a person, both figuratively and literally, you know, in the end. And I mean, even from the very beginning, they are, you know, as we said, you know, meet fruit cute, whatever you want to call it. The very first thing that she does is throw an apple at his head and knock him off a horse. And I mean, that is the cutest of the meet cutes, I think, in any fairy tale retelling that I've seen. And the moment Drew Barrymore, like, I don't know why I didn't like her to start with, but she is so good because the moment that she recognizes that it's the prince and she is just down on the ground instantly, like, oh my god, I know I have to die, etc., etc., and he just wants to get the heck out of there. It's such a delightful scene. So from moment one, you have them on completely different pages, and you get to watch them, like, you know, dancing between the different pages over and over, and they're not on the same page for most of the movie, but then they get there and you do have that feeling that yes, they're going to live. They're not always going to be on the same page. Sometimes they're going to be on different pages, but if they have practice getting on the same page, so we feel like, you know, maybe it's not going to be entirely happy ever after, but they are going to be together ever after because they know how, they've learned how to be together.
And he knows that she can bench press him, so he better not try anything. Moment where she saves him. God,
so good.
Again, like, very formative, because this was 98. So this was before we started having that narrative of the princess saves herself, right? Like, that, this was like a big choice to have her. And I can't remember what the story is, but I read somewhere that came from a specific story about.
It's another one of the historically based things involving another king or something, but it was a deal made with the king of, you know, I can carry, exactly taken out of a historical story, which maybe the original historical story was embellished or something, but I'd like to believe that's exactly how it went. And often, to borrow the title of another movie that we talked about recently on the show, sometimes real life is stranger than fiction, and is delightful in that respect.
I think, like, we've acknowledged that there's some problematic elements with the Romani people and the stereotypes, but I think for that time period, they were also trying to create a fuller picture and counter that narrative a little bit by bringing them in as a real group of people who, once they, that turning point is like, oh, come on. And then they take care of each other and they feed you and they, like, they become people instead of the enemy. And yeah, it's just like, I think they tried. They, of course, were still using problematic language, but it's better than other things we've seen.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I also want to shout out, this is a Canadian classic, The Paper Bag Princess, published in 1980. Robert Munsch. I don't know how that traveled over the border, but if you're a Canadian kid born after, or not born, but like, I think almost all of us would know the story. And it's about a little princess who gets, she's engaged to the prince. Ronald gets captured by a dragon. He fails to save her. She saves herself in a little paper bag. She is, and she ends up like saving herself and discarding the prince. And that story is like beloved here, and every kid has to read it. And it's sort of like that foundation of, yeah, the girl, the princess can save herself narrative. And I love it. And it's such a charming little story.
There is a dance version of that came out of the University of Iowa while I was there. And I can't remember if I just saw it or if I worked on it because I did so much dance. But I vividly remember Paper Bag Princess. And I don't know if I had heard it before then, but it's very much a book that I remember seeing a lot after it happened. Yeah, it's a very cute story.
Leave it to the world of ballet to adapt things that, you know, that that are more progressive than a lot of the quote unquote classics of dance.
It was, I want to say it was done with a traditional classroom projector and puppets in addition to dancers.
Wow. I would have loved to have seen that.
I would like to take a moment to talk about Pierre Lepew.
Oh, yeah.
My God.
Richard O'Brien.
My problematic fave.
Who I see as riffraff. And every time I watch this movie, I just have the greatest of giggles over, first of all, he looks way better in this than he did in the 70s Rocky Horror. But I just, every time I see him, I'm like, that is riffraff in this movie.
Yep.
He is also another excellent caricature that is so over the top.
Yes. And I love that little, and I feel like it should be called out for being really cheesy because it's thrown an element. But when she's like, my father was an expert swordsman and he taught me. And I'm like, you were 8 years old. I don't know how expert you were at eight, but like access to swords growing up. Sure. I believe it.
My headcanon for that is that, like, yeah, she learned a little bit when she was eight, and then she sort of practiced some more, and she's maybe not actually an expert swordsman, but she is really good at bluffing.
She is being Wesley in The Princess Bride at the moment where, like, he stands up and it's like, drop your sword. It's like, it's bluff, but it's confident bluff, and she wins.
My angle on this is that as someone with a significant amount of sword training, the most dangerous scene partner that I can have in stage combat is somebody who doesn't know what they're doing or is inexpert in the traditional way that things are taught, who understands the basic principles because you have no idea what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that having the surprise of that confidence of the bluff, to Annette's point, I think is something that partially disarms him. And the other thing is she is wildly competent at all kinds of things and is one of the few people in France, apparently, who seems to really be aware of her surroundings. Everybody else is just kind of, you know, taken aback by everything. And she is the most unflappable character in the whole movie.
She has all that practice whooping Gustav from childhood. Yes, true. So, you know,
mm-hmm. Gustav, yes. Who is like best friend goals because he does her hair every time, almost every time.
God, so well.
I had never paid attention. I had paid attention to her hair being different when she was fancy versus herself, but I was really paying attention to him saying, let's do something about your hair. And then the next scene, she's every time they take her from peasant to fake countess, there's like her hair's actually been brushed and the wig work is so beautiful in this movie. But, I really love this idea that her little friend who she beats up as a child can like style her hair all fancy.
He's very much the gay best friend character without being coded as the gay best friend character.
Yep.
And it's something that again, the side characters of this movie are all interesting enough that yes, I would watch the side story of where Gustav went from here. Because what else did he do? Who is he other than, you know, her best pal? You know, we don't have any stereotyping attached to him at all. But I adore that he just cares about her and wants what's best for her, but then also has his own artistic interests and, you know, gains the attention of all people, Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, it's a nice touch. Like, look at my paintings, like, now, like, while you're as old as I am, you just can't waste any time, basically.
Yeah, like, is he supposed to be Gustav Klimt, or does the history not match up? I don't know.
Yeah, I
wasn't an art
that.
History major.
Same. I have no idea.
Well, I think we are getting to the time where we can do a round of final thoughts, and I'm going to do it in the same order I introduced you and start with Katie Beth.
I love that when he woos her, he takes her to a library.
Mm. Yes.
How romantic. Mm-hmm. How Beauty and the Beast. And I also would just like to say, this is such a visually pleasing film that it is one of those you can just kind of look at and not pay attention to and have a great time. And there's that, it's gorgeous. You see the seasons. They filmed in France. They're at real chateaus. And the beekeeping scene where they're just casually keeping bees with their little beekeeping outfits is just very like 1998 version of cottagecore, and I love that. And this movie just is cozy, and it makes me want to inhabit this world, but maybe not without indoor plumbing.
Yeah, I'm with you. How about for you, Erica?
Yeah, this movie just, it's such a comfort watch. And I mean, I grew up reading fairy tales. Like, I had multiple books of Grimm's fairy tales, and like that was always a comfort thing for me. But I feel like this reaches another level of comfort watch because of all of the work that it does to sort of pull itself away from the stereotypical fairy tales where, the you know, nobody has a real personality and it's just all about, you know, thing X happens, thing Y happens, things Z happens, et cetera, et cetera. And here we have all of the people and all of the characters. And because it feels so real, it somehow is just more escapist to me, because the idea of real people actually getting, you know, to have the happy ending like this is, to me, even more uplifting than a fantastical, you know, somebody who has an actual fairy godmother getting to have a happy ending. Well, yeah, of course they're going to have a happy ending. There's magic. There's no magic here. This is just people muddling along and trying to do their best, and they end up in a good place. And I think especially like right now in the world, I have been moving more and more toward comfort and escapist sort of fiction where the end is joy, the end is happiness, the end is people achieving things that they have worked hard to get. And I will probably watch this movie a dozen more times in, you know, probably not a huge span of time, simply because it just makes me feel good in that way.
Yeah, it is a nice one. Moises.
Oh, well, I think that my distinguished co-panelists have really covered just about everything important. So I'll focus on the frivolous. I cannot wait for our inaugural Smooch Slumber Party event to take place, where we gather a bunch of people together and just watch stuff in pajamas, because this movie is a great candidate for a thing to watch with a bunch of people. And going back to the notion of property and mergers and acquisitions and everything, one of the happier parts of the Disney acquisition of Fox is that now Drew Barrymore's Cinderella is a Disney princess.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I watched it on Disney Plus, so of course, how did I not put that together?
Yes. I am going to use my final thought to build on what Moises just said and now be thinking about the Agents of Spooch pajamas.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. All we need is patterned fabric.
We need, like, oh yeah, I'm like picturing this. I've got to have some time on my hands. We need to.
I need mine in deep burgundy with the Smooch logo in pink. The lips be pink.
Yeah, but also, like, our pajama pants need, mm-hmm. like, lips all over them, and then you need,
that's
like,
what I'm
a
saying.
Logo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, uh-huh. Like,
mm-hmm. Like, yeah, embroidered
I'm
pocket.
I'm super distracted now.
And so, the dice.
This has to happen. But in the meantime, until we see you again, everyone, stay safe, agents. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network. If you are enjoying our show, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the Smooch Agency, you can become a member of the Incomparable at theincomparable.com/members. Members can choose to support us and any other shows on the network, and you get extra perks like hanging out in the members-only Slack channel and bonus content such as our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. Thank you for listening. Your next mission will be coming to you soon.